3, 2. Hey, web friends. Before we get to this episode, I wanted to talk to you real quick. This is the season one finale of Web Friends. Don't worry, though. Season two dates and guests are getting lined up, and we'll be announcing that soon. But if you've listened to the show before, you might have noticed that all the guests in season one have been my personal friends. They are awesome and inspiring to me, and I'm happy to share them with you, but I wanted to know who are your web friends. So I set up a form on webfriends.io for you to nominate a friend to be on the show. If we get some good submissions, we'll start to use them in future episodes, and we might call you up to have you introduce them to the rest of the listener audience. So take a look when you get a second. Also, follow us on Twitter at webfriends.io for updates before season two comes out. Thanks again for listening. I'm your host, Garth Braithwaite, and this is Web Friends. Three, two. All right, web friends, this is the last episode of season one, and I couldn't think of a better way to end it than to interview Brian LaRue. Before we get to the interview, though, let me introduce him to you by telling you how I met Brian. Years ago, for an old podcast I hosted, I cold called Brian to talk to him about PhoneGap. At the time, Brian was at an agency called Natobi, where he helped work on a fairly new project called PhoneGap, which lets you leverage web technology like HTML, CSS, and JavaScript to build native mobile applications for just about every mobile platform. And he's actually still working on PhoneGap today. And even though I intended to speak to him the whole time about PhoneGap, we ended up talking more about Natobi and the way it was organized. Later that year, I was offered a position at Adobe, and Natobi was acquired by Adobe. So eventually, Brian and I ended up working together on a project called Topcoat. Brian has been a great mentor to me, specifically on what community and open source should look like when it's healthy and effective. The advice he's about to share is fantastic, and I hope it helps you as well. So let's jump to the interview right after a quick word from our sponsor.
This episode of Web Friends is sponsored by Campaign Monitor. Sending email campaigns doesn't need to be a chore. Campaign Monitor makes it fun, easy, and beautiful. Try your hand at their template builder and have a responsive email template ready in 60 seconds. Campaign Monitor also lets you offer their services to your clients at your prices. And if you need help creating better emails, Campaign Monitor just released a free ebook with their top 100 email campaigns of 2013. Go to campaignmonitor.com and get started today.
All right, Brian, thanks for joining us. So, first question is, what's some of the best advice that you've received in your professional career or even in your personal life that really has stuck with you?
Well, yeah, so that's always a really tough one because, you know, especially as you get older, you start to realize that there were these wayposts along life that, you know, were significant, but you didn't know it at the time. So professionally, I think one of my favorite, most important moments when I was a much younger programmer, I sat down at a desk beside our new CTO in this kind of enterprise-y startup. This would have been like, I want to say 2002 or something like that. It's quite a while ago. And we were migrating a very large VB6 app over to .NET because Java was no longer fashionable. .NET was the thing to do, and these guys missed the Java boat. And I was actually kind of more of a Java guy. But, you know, I had in common with our CTO at the time that we both hated VB. So this was going to be a pretty easy evisceration of the old code. And for some reason, I had to change like a few thousand files, some naming convention or something. And I was trying to cook up like the quickest way to do this. And I was like writing like a stupid script of some kind. And he's like, no, what are you doing? Leans over, grabs my computer, pops open a shell, writes this long string of characters that looks like complete garbage to me at the time, you know, hits enter, and he's like, you're done, and then pushes my computer back at me. And I'm just looking at this guy like he's a fucking wizard. I'm like, how did you do that, Kevin? And he's like, oh, do you want to learn about the command line? And that was an extremely significant moment for me career-wise. I didn't even know it at that moment because I thought, you know, whatever. Command line is something old guys use. You know, sometimes I have to go in there, but I don't need to have a deep understanding of what it is or why it works. I had no idea about IO redirection or pipes or anything like that. And so Kevin schooled me. And it was a very humbling moment because as a young programmer, you're pretty certain that you know everything at this point. You know, all of it's just syntax. You know, all these tools or whatever doesn't really matter. And the stuff that the old guys are doing, we don't do that anymore because, you know, that stuff's a waste of your time. I think the lesson I learned there wasn't that the command line is important, even though it obviously is. More so, it was about the history of what we do and how we do things and maybe looking at why we don't do them. Today, nowadays, I collect old computer books. I mean, like really old ones, ones from like 70s and 80s. And I love reading these things because history repeats itself a lot, and we are really bad at learning from it in our industry. We're really, really bad at learning from it. But this is a strategic advantage for you as a software developer. If you can acknowledge this, start internalizing kind of older concepts and ideas, you can use those to your profit.
That's awesome. So what sort of things jump out at you when you're looking at books, older books? What topics do you think people should brush up on? Sounds like terminal command line stuff is great.
I mean, that's a key. That's a really big key these days. Even, you know, I'm seeing designers now open up their terminal and, you know, run Jekyll, whatever. Actually, I met some web designers a little while ago that were using Jekyll as an asset pipeline to ultimately generate phone gap apps.
Oh, wow. That's awesome.
That's what I said. I'm like, you know what? That's sweet. These guys are totally using what they know, and they're coming out with something awesome at the end. I think the two kind of big books to read if you're going to get into the history of things, Unix Philosophy, The Art of Unix Programming, I believe is the book. It's in the title. It's by Eric Raymond. This is probably one of the most important texts, possibly of our time. It gets into all the bits and it collects all the Unix wisdom into one place. The actual programming bits in it are a little crusty. You know, there's a lot of C and C++ in there, but definitely the Unix Philosophy is worth reading.
And it looks like it's online.
Yeah, it would be free.
Yeah,
yeah. Eric Raymond. He also wrote Cathedral and Bazaar, which is another great book if you want to understand the business economics of open source. There's another book, also free and available, and it's called The Unix Haters Handbook. So if you're going to go have a fanboy moment about Unix, I highly recommend reading this to balance your perspective, because there's lots of good reasons to not like Unix. It didn't solve everything. And it's a good one. It's also probably one of the most eloquent trolls ever written in our age.
It looks like it's also, the PDF is just put online. I'll put these in the show notes, but it's on MIT's website. So,
yeah, every programmer has to read both of these. They're crucial. But I mean, like, I go to Powell's Books in Portland whenever I visit, and I usually buy like a backpack worth of books every time I go, and I pick up, you know, like Smalltalk 80 system design from the 80s, or I'm just going to look at my bookshelf and see what I see. ANSI Common List, Lisp, Codes in Cryptography, you know, any of these kind of books, just pick them up, thumb through them. I've got a book about grep here that's like, you know, from the early 90s. All these things are like useful to go read and digest and check out and gloss over and understand those bits and pieces of tech work. If your stack of the day doesn't happen to implement something, that doesn't mean it isn't possible.
Yeah, that's awesome. And that's a fantastic point of view to bring our perspective. Because there are a lot of new web developers, and we just take for granted kind of where we've come from. And like you were mentioning, like the idea of naming something right now, if I had to rename a ton of files, I might look at doing a grunt or a gulp type of thing before, you know, I could find a single line solution with the command line.
Yeah, exactly. And I don't know if the command line was the right thing or not, actually, but I think the point was is that, you know, Kevin used to have some awesome sayings where it was like, you know, the point of a computer is to automate things, you know, to get everything out of the way. He also taught me a lot about unit testing and, you know, the importance of regression testing. And if you ever have a bug, if it manifests again, this is considered unprofessional, that type of thing. And like, not unit testing has actually kind of been getting raked over the coals lately, and I think that's interesting. There's still always a time for tests, in my mind.
Yeah. Yeah. I inherited this week. I had an emergency project that I had to finish or help someone with, and they sent me the source code, and it's a Node project. And as soon as I realized there wasn't a test folder, I automatically estimated like double the amount of time that I thought it was going to take. Just because it becomes a complete unknown when there are no tests.
I actually inherited a project very recently too. And they were like, well, where are you going to start? And I'm like, oh, this is perfect. I know exactly where to start. I'm going to write a test for this thing because there are none. And it's a good way to reason about a system. It's a good way to tease a system apart and build it into more modular pieces so that you can isolate functionality and actually prove it corrects its correctness. Yeah.
So if you did inherit a project that didn't have any tests, you would start by writing some tests?
Yeah, that's how I'd do it. I'm not saying that's the right way to do it for everybody.
Yeah.
A motivated programmer is more important than a programmer with a mandate.
Yeah.
If that's how I reason about things. I have a terrible short-term memory. If I'm working on something today, there is no way that I'll be able to describe what it was I was working on tomorrow. And so having a bunch of tests laying around, first thing I do is I run.
Yeah.
And sometimes if I'm feeling sort of like a dick to myself, I'll leave a failing test behind. And then, but that's a great way. Then as soon as I see that red, I'm one of those people, if there's any kind of outcome I can affect into a better resolution, especially if it's a number going up, or you know, if I know red's bad and green is good, I have to see green.
Yeah, like the notifications on emails that tell you how many you have unread. I can't handle those. I've got to get them down to zero. And same thing about tests, but leaving a failing test seems like a brilliant way to know exactly where to come back. When you leave a project for a week because you're doing something else, and you come back, you're like, all right, where am I?
Yep. Exactly.
Yeah, you have a failing test, you know exactly where to pick up.
It's super true. So that was like professional advice, which is always good. And then like on a more of a personal level or personal life advice, I'm not sure where it came about, but at some point, I think it was like 4 years ago, maybe longer. Actually, it would have been before PhoneGap, so it would have been like 6 or 7 years ago. I was having back problems. Pretty common. Actually, my girlfriend Joni was having back problems too. And so, you know, visit a doctor and talk to them about it. And turns out that, you know, a herniated disc for tech workers is very, very common.
Hmm.
We sit on our asses. And at this point, I'd probably been sitting on my ass for about 10 years, writing code and leaning too far into the laptop. And, you know, the back gets pretty seized up. And so the doctor was like, you can get surgery, back surgery, in your 30s, or you could start doing yoga. So I started doing yoga. And that was, so I went only purely for the physical part of the practice, ultimately. I wanted to fix my back and limber up and maybe get into slightly better shape. And it turned out the mental aspects of the practice were way more important to me. So yoga is not... it can be a spiritual thing if you want it to be. I don't think that's the thing. I think the thing is learning how to deal with discomfort in a graceful manner. Mm-hmm. And to kind of seek balance instead of purity. You know, as a software hacker, if I'm not spending time learning or writing code, I'm kind of, you know, in a very narrow view, I'm kind of like wasting my time. At least that's the way I used to think. And you see actually a lot of this down in San Francisco where it's like, you know, we're expecting our staff to work 10-hour days because we're a startup that's going to change the world. This is a huge load of shit. You want balance, not purity. This is a yogic way of thinking. It's really important to spend time with family, friends, and ultimately on your health, your body. And you'll find that when you do that, you become more relaxed in uncomfortable positions, and you become a better communicator, and you get more open and flexible. And more things happen. You're more prepared for your work because you're rested, and you're not ready to react in a negative manner.
And what? How do you go about getting started in something like yoga? Do you just, hey, let me pull out Google and search for someplace close to me, or?
I mean, yeah, it's all about like the teacher, really, at the beginning. If you have a crummy teacher, you're going to have probably a crummy experience.
Yeah.
So I wouldn't give up after the first class either. Some of it takes years. I think real point of isn't necessarily, I'm not trying to say, hey, people, you should go do yoga, although I think people should. I think more is about finding time, not programming, finding time to like work on your health, work on you, you know, invest in yourself. Those are important things to do.
Yeah.
And I'm terrible at this too. I go through phases where I'll lapse and I'll work my ass off for weeks on end. But ultimately you end up paying that cost. You're just running up a debt that's really not worth it long run.
Yeah. Yeah. I've never gotten done doing like two. There have been a couple times where I've done a couple late nights in a row working on something. I've never been done and be like, I'm really glad I did that. That was a smart choice.
Yeah, right? Or, wow, that code I wrote at 3 a.m. was brilliant.
Yeah.
No one says that.
And it's usually for rush projects that it's a demo or it's something that, hey, we need to get this out because we're going to show it to somebody. And then after the fact, you kind of realize, you know, it wasn't as important as we thought it was.
No, it almost never is.
Yeah.
And the thing is with that, especially that type of code, you're just actually delaying the inevitable that you have to do it properly.
Yeah.
Which you'd think would be like the key thing that even the person receiving the demo would want to know. Like if you're just showing duct tape and band-aids off, the next question is, when's this ready for production? If they're staring at something that appears to be ready for production, you're not doing anyone any favors.
Yeah. Yeah. I was doing the, we were doing a hackathon, an internal hackathon for Adobe, and the last day, we called it salted earth coding because you were getting to the point where you were coding so bad that you know whoever's coming after you is not going to be able to fix it easily. Like, it's going to take some time. So, yeah, that's great advice. So I noticed you had some pictures on Instagram of you and Joni doing yoga with, like, a sitting desk that you had.
Oh, God. Yeah, well, so no, in our place in San Francisco, we've got an awesome dining room, which somehow became a personal yoga studio. So we'll use it for a dining room if we're going to have guests, but otherwise we just leave it with our mats. And sometimes we want to work from home. And I realized, hey, I don't need to sit at a desk. I could sit on a block and put a chair in front of me and have perfect posture while I work. So I gave that a try for a day, and it's actually really hard. So if you're sitting properly, and I'm air quoting right now for all of you at home, but if you're sitting with a straight spine on a block and opening your hips so that your knees are falling to the ground, it's pretty easy to do to get to that point. When you first start doing yoga, you might not be there for a little while, but after a few weeks, you will be. And I can sit that way for about an hour maybe.
Mm-hmm.
And after that, it gets super hard. Your body just wants to collapse on itself. And that's why you see like people with their like chin jutting out and they got like a neck that's kind of like shaped like a vulture's, and you know they're hunched over their computer. It's really, really bad for your spine. And ultimately, if something's bad for your spine, it's going to affect your mind. If you're in any form of pain whatsoever, it's going to limit your capacity for compassion and how you interact with other people. If your back hurts, you're going to be bitchy, basically, is what it boils down to. And so you don't want to get into that position.
Yeah. Yeah, I got a standing desk, and I'd be like, when I first got it, I'm like, oh, I'm going to stand all day.
It's hard.
Yeah. No, and there's certain activities I can't do standing. Emails are fine, but like when I start getting into doing design, I can't do it. It's almost like the effort of standing distracts from coming up with something creative for me. It's different for other people, but yeah, certain activities I can't do. In certain positions, it's weird.
I find the same thing. I'm totally the same way. I find I like to write code on my stomach, believe it or not.
Hmm.
Laying on the ground on my stomach, for some reason, has become a comfortable position for me to do that. But like email or something, I like to lay on my back on the couch.
And that's funny.
Generally, I want to stand. I'm the same way. I know I'm supposed to stand. This is the better way to do things. But my feet get tired, and I find it's like a I almost feel like I'm supposed to be going somewhere if I'm standing.
Yeah, like you're like getting anxious to leave.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know what it is. It's hard to focus, though. That's, I guess, the big epidemic of our industry right now is attention.
Yeah, yeah. That's, and we've got so many things distracting us. So this is great advice. I like the professional, which is be aware of the past, and then the personal, which is a little bit towards balance, but talking about, you know, take care of your body as well. Take some time to focus on things other than code.
Mm-hmm.
Once in a while. That's great. So that's the first question, is what's the best advice you've received? The second one is, if you had a chance to go back and to talk to past Brian, what's some advice you would give? What are some things that you wish you could have known ahead of time that you learned the hard way?
Yeah, I think, and I see this actually really, really common anyways, and it might just be a general phase in our industry that you have to go through, but I'm a big fan of the idea of equanimity. So being calm in the face of, you know, discomfort. When I was a younger programmer, I was a passionate programmer, as we tend to be. And I would get pissed, man. You know, if something was being done wrong or we were doing something incorrectly, I would shout and I would be mad. And really, while our job appears to be writing text, it's actually about communication. And nobody wants to work with someone who yells and gets upset and is frustrated.
Yeah.
Can't act in a, you know, calm manner. So sociopaths know this, and unfortunately that means that they can operate usually with a high degree of flexibility in large organizations because they just never get bent out of shape. People that are passionate are normal, and it's totally fine, but you got to learn how to curb that and channel it in the right ways and know when it matters. There's nothing wrong with being pissed. You can acknowledge that, but there's everything wrong with letting that be expressed out to people. So I think younger Brian could have learned a lesson that just to shut up and listen. I think that's a big part of it. And just being a little more calm and accepting of what's going on. I wasn't always right, even though I thought I was. And maybe I was right, but it ultimately probably didn't matter.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. Christopher Joseph in a previous episode said something similar.
Yeah, Christopher and I are pretty similar in that regard, I think.
Yeah. The way he phrased it, and he said it several times working with him, he's like, if you're the same person, I found that if you're the same person, the only sane person in a room full of insane people yelling at them, you look insane.
that's absolutely true. Yeah.
So how do you accomplish something? That's the hard part, right? Like I found that if you're super passionate about something, it's easy to get worked up. And sometimes to compensate for that, we just try to shut ourselves off. We're like, we don't care. This is a terrible job and this is how it is. And you just kind of kill off parts of your.
Well, yeah, that's a terrible outcome. And that sadly happens a lot where you'll see, especially in big orgs where, you know, developers will check out. Just be like, well, my opinion doesn't matter. Cool. I'll just show up at 9 and leave at 5.
Yeah.
Just kind of like, you know, death by corporate bureaucracy. Terrible thing. I don't know. Like, it's a leadership issue, really. If I identify a team member of ours kind of getting passionately upset, the right way to deal with it is obviously in private, not in public. Just be like, yo, pro tip, that is not going to be the path to achieving the results that you want. I guess you're kind of lucky if you have a leader that will take the time to do that. Sometimes people just let other people melt down and learn this one the hard way. I did. I mean, it took me a long time to reach a point where I realized that if I want to get the outcomes I want, I'm going to have to work with people I don't like, that have opinions I don't share, that operate in ways that I don't agree with. And that's life, man. That's just how it works. And it's tough because, you know, everywhere in our industry, you'll say, yeah, I want passionate people. I want people that are, you know, really into their craft. Passionate doesn't mean that you have to flip out, though.
You know, we say that a lot, though, but sometimes it's hard to actually put those qualities into orgs. Like a lot of people are like, I want passionate people. I want people who do stuff that's innovative. But to be honest, if you're doing innovative stuff, you're going to have a hard road. Like, it's just kind of how it is. You get faced with people who are adverse to change.
Absolutely.
So that, yeah.
I think that's it's one of the tests, right? Like, if you're doing something worthwhile, people are going to say you're doing it wrong.
Yeah.
And it's about learning how to deal with that. Maybe, ultimately, the outcome you would want is to persuade that person that you're actually right. And butting heads is usually a bad way to get there.
Yeah. You mentioned before Eric Raymond and the bazaar. What is it?
Cathedral and the Bazaar.
Cathedral and the Bazaar. He talks a little bit about how open source feels a little bit more chaotic.
Yes. open source is really tricky. So there's tons of ego organizations. Now there's lots of history too. I mean, open source is not a new thing by any stretch. It's been going on since before the 80s, really. It's a scientific method ultimately, but it's it has a lot of people. And when you add a lot of people to something, you're going to have conflicts. And I don't know, the other problem with open source, or not problem, but another interesting aspect of open source, another property of open source, is that a lot of our communication happens via text.
Yeah.
And email is, I said this the other day, and I actually think I'm onto something with this, but email has become a protocol, a shitty protocol for to-do lists. And it is totally not a communication tool. Even though we pretend it is, it's not. It's just a protocol for to-do lists. And communication is now happening in all these different ways. We've got Twitter, we have Facebook, Skype, Slack, you know, IRC, whatever. And almost any of those tools is a better tool for communicating than email. And yet, most open source interaction is happening. Oh, GitHub, obviously, another big one.
Yeah.
Most open source interaction is happening usually on mailing lists.
Yeah.
We're seeing a slow migration to GitHub issues or issue trackers, maybe Jira if you're in more of an enterprise-y situation, or Apache.
But that really only takes care of the to-do list. That doesn't take care of necessarily the communication.
Yeah, and you'll have like really soft debates. So in Apache Cordova, we started to build up a fair amount of tension with Google a while ago. So it was a lot of Adobe committers, a lot of Google committers. Everyone had opinions, and the only thing we had in common was that everybody else was wrong. And things escalated. You know, it was starting to get actually a little tense. I think there were animated GIFs flying around that were sort of jokingly showing these things. And we decided to have a Google Hangout, which we decided to do face-to-face, and we had several of them, different satellite offices. And within 10 minutes of that Hangout, all of the conflict dissipated completely. And everyone recognized it. We were like, holy shit, we just needed to talk to each other.
Did you record it? Like,
we did. We record all of them.
Yeah.
They're all online somewhere. If you just did a Google for like Cordova Hangouts, you could probably find a few of them. And so this has actually come into a little bit of conflict with Apache. Because Apache, the common wisdom is that if it doesn't happen on the mailing list, it didn't happen. And the reason for that rule, even though it's a little dated, the reason for it is that the world is distributed across all these different time zones, and we don't want to exclude the opinions of committers that could be in a time zone that's sleeping currently.
Yeah.
Which is 100% valid. I think you can mitigate that by combining tools like Hangouts and even better, face-to-face conferences with email. But a regular face-to-face makes a huge difference for conflict. For some reason, when a person gets an email, the first thing they do is assume the guy sending it's an asshole. And, you know, over a decade in this industry, even I still do it. I'll get an email and I'll be like, what the hell is this person thinking? Come on, mom. Or whatever, right? And it's really wrong. And then you talk to them and you're like, oh, I thought you meant this. And they didn't mean that at all. So
yeah,
I don't know what the answer is to that, but it's a thing.
That's a good point. And it's interesting, even if you do supplement, we found that with Topcoat, we found that if we just had a Google Hangout that with our team, or if we had we moved to Slack, the ability to just kind of casually communicate. Email feels like you said, it's tasks. Anything that comes in an email is like, hey, I need you to do this. While some IM of some sort, instant message of some sort, usually is a little bit more casual, like, hey, I just want to think through something. And it becomes much more like a conversation. But yeah, that's a real problem in our industry. And it's a problem internally too in enterprise organizations, because then you got the whole security thing of more communication, and we need to capture this communication in case we need to turn it into a to-do list or whatever else. Yeah, it's a nightmare.
Yeah, that's true. Well, so, you know, more power to Slack, because I think that they're definitely onto something for fixing this. We've deployed it for the PhoneGap team, and we did it with Topcoat too.
Yeah,
a while back, and I love it. I think it's killed our need for a daily stand-up call.
Yeah,
most of our communication is now totally asynchronous and ad hoc, and it's fine. And my inbox load has lessened significantly. I've noticed it. So it's working, whatever it is.
And it has some fun integration with stuff like GitHub. It'll do stuff, and then you can put in bots like an old IRC. The one problem I have with Slack over IRC, which I'd love to see addressed, is with open source projects, you have to invite people to teams. Like, you can't just have an open communication format with Slack. So, which is a good thing and a bad thing, right? Like, sometimes you want to cut down on the noise, and restricting the access to it sometimes helps with that.
Yeah, I mean, it's a funny bit. It's interesting. So at Apache, one of the things that we want to avoid is infrastructure that's owned by a privately held organization. And really, it's not because we're afraid they're going to go do anything malicious. We're actually just, you know, afraid they're going to go away.
Yeah,
that's what happens to private organizations.
Yeah. You
put all your eggs in that basket, then you could be in trouble later. And so we've taken it to an extreme at Apache where email, our source code repositories, our issue tracker, our wiki, everything is hosted by us, and so we're maintaining all this infrastructure. I think chat shouldn't matter personally, because that's ephemeral junk. I don't care about chats from 2009. I will never go back and read those. But I suppose you might want like a record or something, but there is a need for a Slack-like tool for open source that would be, I guess, free open source itself, and or at least could be hosted on premise.
So I like to think of is go back and check out the chats if someone was like writing a documentary type of book of like the history of PhoneGap.
I mean, maybe. I don't know though. Like, those things to me could, you know, this would actually be a great feature. Imagine if email expired. You know, they self-destructed after 7 days. Wouldn't that be wonderful?
It totally doesn't mind whether it's supposed to or not. I'm like, delete all. Nailed it. So productive. All right. Well, we're going to go ahead and wrap things up. But Brian, this advice is fantastic. And I want to point people to where they can find you. And you have brian.io, but you don't do a ton of stuff on there, right?
No, I don't. I'm a really, you know, cobbler's kids, bad shoes kind of thing. I don't know. Someday I'll work on my website.
But
mostly I got that so that I'd have a really short domain so I could have a short email address to type on phones.
It is a fantastic domain.
Yeah. Yeah. The IO thing's pretty cool.
So brian.io, it does have links to other things where other people can find you. It's like, you got twitter.com/BrianLaRoux, which is LEROUX. And you're on GitHub as well. There's a lot of activity of stuff that you're doing, on there, and you're Brian LaRoux there as well, right?
Yeah, I'm Brian LaRoux all over the internet. Personal branding win.
Nice. we can make fun of Adam Morse for that. He was on the last episode. He had like three different URLs and names. All right. Well, thank you so much, Brian. This was our season finale. Usually the seasons are going to be about this size, about 9 to 10 episodes. The reason that we're stopping at 9 is because I'm having a baby tomorrow.
Congratulations, Garrett.
Thanks. So,
how many babies is that?
This is number 5. Yeah. So I need a break for a couple weeks, but we'll be doing the episodes after that. We'll be getting the schedule together here soon. But stay tuned. We'll keep tweeting on WebFriends.io. And we'll be talking about the upcoming season here soon. But thanks for listening. Three, two. Great season finale, huh? I was really curious who was going to get that last rose. So last piece of advice before we go on break. Do the right thing for the right reason. Your motivations will shine through your actions. So make sure your heart is in the right place when you decide to do something. Don't just do things because they will get you attention. Find ways to help others out because you are a decent human being who likes to help others. Even if you get nothing out of it, you will feel better when you try to help. Thanks everyone for listening to this new podcast. I've been surprised and humbled by the feedback from listeners, and I really appreciate it. Like I mentioned at the beginning of the episode, we are looking to hear from new people on the show. We want to know who your good friends and mentors are that have helped you in your career so that we might have them on the show and maybe have you do the intro. So go nominate your friends to be guests on the show at webfriends.io and fill out the form. Please keep in touch on Twitter over the break Follow the show at webfriends.io. Thanks to our first season sponsor, Campaign Monitor. Also a big thanks to the gang at Good Stuff Broadcast Network. They really made WebFriends possible. Go take a look at the other great shows on the network at goodstuff.fm. And most of all, thanks to you. You truly are awesome.